Oh, sorry. There's three of them in the dot.
That's okay.
Beginning of the universe. Take 15. Yeah, that's very beautiful. Hi, that was so great.
So is that a scrap take, would you say?
Yeah, scrap that one.
You're listening to the Clear Spot on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, Phil England, and tonight's studio guest, Leo Murray, who's part of the team that's about to bring you a remarkable independent crowd-funded film on climate change to a cinema near you. It's remarkable for many reasons, not just because it achieves high-budget looks on a relative shoestring, but also because it packs an immense amount of detail and information into a film that has, at its heart, six very human stories and which delivers a powerful emotional punch. It's essentially a documentary, but it comes wrapped in a cunning, dramatic conceit. It's 2055, and the Oscar-nominated actor Pete Postlethwaite is one of the human survivors in a world dramatically transformed by climate change. He looks back at archive footage from our present and asks, why didn't we do something when we had the chance? Later on, we'll be speaking to director Franny Armstrong by telephone. In the meantime, though, we're very pleased to have Leo Murray in the studio, who's worked on some of the animation sequences in the film and is now part of the Age of Stupid's media team, I believe. Is that right?
Hello, Phil. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So perhaps you can tell me, I mean, I'm imagining working with Franny is a bit of a kind of whirlwind existence. I know that when she took on her producer, she asked her basically to give up all her social life.
Yes, she did, yes.
Were you also under such strict instructions?
She hasn't really needed to ask me, to be honest. It's happening anyway, you know. I think most of the people that are on Team Stupid are people that are freaked out about climate change already and you know, committed to doing something about it. So we're working 12, 14-hour days at the moment, but that's okay.
Presumably for not huge
not for huge remuneration. No, it's fair to say.
I mean, it's a film that's been done on the cheap. I know originally she was trying to raise something like 50,000, and then her budget went up to 450,000. But by kind of Hollywood standards, that's still fairly cheap.
It's peanuts by Hollywood standards. It's peanuts, but you know, from the standards of maker of shoestring documentaries, she's constantly surprised by how much money she's managed to spend. Yeah, they started out with 50 grand back in 2004, which they raised in basically in a single night, but they spent it pretty quickly and then went back with rushes and pitched to another crowd of people, because the money for this film, it hasn't come from one source. You know, it hasn't even come from a couple of sources. It's come from at last count it was 223 different individuals and groups who've all basically chipped in to make this film happen. People putting in, you know, 50 quid at the very least, clubbing together basically to make this happen.
They're calling it crowdfunding. What makes it different? Is it because people aren't really looking to make a huge buck out of it at the end of the day? They're more into it because they want to see the film made.
Yeah, it's certainly not a money-spinning enterprise, I think it's fair to say. Although, I mean, we're hoping that people get their money back. It's not probably a brilliant investment, although perhaps better than gambling on the stock exchange in recent times. But the crowdfunding thing, the reason they went for that, you know, Franny got a good pedigree. You know, McLibel did very well. She probably could have got funding to make this film from more traditional sources. But when you do that, you lose editorial control. And she didn't want that, you know. You know, really, this is Franny's vision. No one has mucked about with it at all.
Yeah, I just wonder how much we can embarrass Franny before we can call her up on the phone. Can I just ask you what she's like to work with?
Franny is an absolute control freak. She's one of the biggest control freaks I've ever met. But having said that, she's incredibly effective at getting things done. She's inspirational to work with. She's quite bossy and, you know, she expects to get her own way most of the time. But, you know, she usually does. And the fact is she's usually right. So it's good. It's a good working relationship. And I think anyone on the team would say the same thing.
I mean, she's made an extraordinary run of films over her career, if you like. She might not want to call it a career. Because seems to have like fallen into filmmaking in a sense. But
yeah, she didn't. She never planned to do it. You know, it just dad basically gave her a camera one day and said, why don't you make a film about this? You know, because...
Which happened to be the McLibel trial,
which wound up being the biggest libel, you know, the longest running libel trial in history, and you know, massive global news story with a successful outcome as well. So, you know, a happy story, and you know, the film she made off the back of that McLibel has done extremely well.
But again, the independent mindedness that she had to kind of batter away at that. I believe she made a version for Channel 4 at one point, and they back down.
Yeah, they chickened
out. Everybody backs down. Used to back down because they're just afraid of being sued by McDonald's.
That's right. They chickened out. You know, they chickened out. Channel 4 chickened out. BBC chickened out. And so, you know, it never got broadcast for ages. But then years later, she had to make a re-edit of it. And it was screened on British television and millions of viewers. So
probably only after the McLibel 2 had taken their case all the way to the European
and basically won
Court of
yeah.
Human Rights and beat the British government and said that
it
was an unfair trial, basically. We're weighted against us.
Yeah, exactly. And after that point, you know, it suddenly became all right to screen it.
So talking about doing things on the cheap, you were involved in the very opening sequence of this film.
We certainly did do that on the cheap.
And Pete Postlethwaite has described the opening sequence as being, you know, Spielberg, eat your heart out.
Yeah, I was very touched by that.
And it's the beginning of the universe, basically. And this was your doing. You created the universe in the basement of the Royal College of Art, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. I was halfway through my master's in animation when I saw the job being advertised. Actually, all the shooting for the film was over by this point, and it had gone through a couple of edits, and they decided it needed animation to string it together. So Franny kind of rewrote the entire script, put in this dramatic conceit of the future, which meant an incredibly ambitious... I mean, I don't think she knew very much about animation and, you know, how it's produced when she decided that she wanted to do this thing. But amazingly managed to rope in a whole bunch of animators. I mean, when I saw the job advert, I was really excited by it because I was already a climate activist and I was already working on my own film about climate change. When I saw this advert for, you know, 60 quid a day, some assistance money working on this film, and that was back when it was called Crude, it described me with jaw-dropping accuracy, you know, the job description. So I was delighted to be offered the work. And then Franny gave us, my friend Bill and I, who I roped in to do it with me, Bill Porter, she gave us this horrible, terrifying brief of basically create the beginning of the universe and don't make it look CGI, right, when computer generated. So we did a bit of scratching our heads over that. And then Bill had been doing this lovely work with milk in water. And so we decided that was a good starting point, you know, different liquids in water. And so we got the glass and ceramics department at the RCA to make us these little glass orbs so that we could have an unobstructed view, you know. And then we spent a very, very long day in the basement at the RCA filling these things with water and then dropping single drops of milk in. But of course, you had to change the water every time, which meant walking down the corridor. And we did nearly 100 takes. But then we mixed that together with real footage of explosions and fire, and then a little bit of sneaky CGI around the edges, which is quite difficult to spot, I think. So it's mostly real footage of explosions mixed together with milk, which we've messed around with the speed that it runs at. My brother's a physicist, and he says it looks like the beginning of the universe.
Oh, he would know.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can hear a bit of the kind of basement action now, I believe.
So here we are down in the dungeon at the Royal College of Art, and we are creating the beginning of the universe. Here's Bill, and it's all taking place in there. Second try. We are
rehearsing my drips.
The stuff of life. Oh, are you ready? The universe is about to begin.
About in the middle.
Am I right? Yeah.
Slightly off centre, but it looks alright.
Yeah, only slightly off centre. Looks good though. Okay, so, beginning of the universe. Take 15. That was so great. That really was the dog's bollocks.
So I think, because we're going to try and get Franny up on the phone, we're going to play another little clip, which is Pete Postlethwaite, kind of before and after. This is Franny interviewing Pete Postlethwaite on the day of the filming and getting his initial reactions. And then sounding in a more kind of lively, perhaps... after a pint or two down in the pub, after the first screen, after the first time Pete had had the opportunity to see the film, and somebody else, I think, getting his reactions about that. We'll hear that, and hopefully we'll have a Franny at the other end of this.
What are you doing here, Pete?
God knows. doing something really worthwhile, actually, yeah. With a bunch of people who I really respect. I think it's lovely to be on a set where people actually want to be there and do what they're doing. I'm actually amazed at the setup you've got going. Fantastic.
Thanks.
I'm not saying that just because we're on camera now. No, it's good. I was terrified this morning.
Were you?
Yeah.
Why?
I was. Oh, it's really because.
When you saw all that dialogue?
No, I knew the dialogue was going to be true, but I knew that there's no way you would. Know it.
Yeah.
I know where it could be. And because of the subject that we're dealing with, it's something important, something, you know, something that we really, really need to address.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, you can't blow this. But after we sat down for that first half hour and three quarters of an hour and we worked out that system of doing it, yeah. I just thought, no, okay, we can do this.
Great. Do this. And why did you decide to do this when you first got an email or however we contacted you?
You know, when you look at the subject, you read what you're trying to do. There was no option really. Had to do it.
And what do you think now you've done it? Smash it or total turkey?
No idea in terms of that, but I know what you're trying to do and I know what the criteria is and what the qualities that you want out of it.
And what the stakes are as well, of course.
The stakes are very, very high. Stakes are through the roof. But I think your commitment and your desire to do something slightly stranger with a documentary as well, because it's a mixture, it's not just documentary, it's all sorts of. And I think that's very exciting and very, I think regardless of whether it's a hit or a turkey, I think what you do is you sit back and you say, we've made it, we did it, we've made that.
Stunned. I think to pack that much information, detail, and fact into a film that is exciting, moving, keeps you engaged all the way through is phenomenal. It's an extraordinary achievement. I said to a guy over there I've just been talking to from Friends of the Earth, doing an interview with him, and I said, it's Spielberg, eat your heart out that first 10 minutes. I think it'll make people think. I think it'll make people debate. I think it'll freshen their memories if they don't already know about, you know, what the hell's going on. That's all you can do. I don't think it's preachy in any way. It's not polemic. It's not actually saying no. It's I think it's strong. I think it'll make people think. I think people will be moved by it. I hope they'll be moved.
That film.
Yeah. How you doing?
Good. Yourself?
Yeah. Not bad. Thanks. Maybe you could just tell us a bit about the kind of genesis of this movie and what you were actually trying to do at the outset. What was your idea, really?
Well, the original plan way back in 2002 was to pinch the structure of Steven Soderbergh's film Traffic, which I don't know if you remember it, but it was six human interweaving human stories all about the drugs trade. And it's just a really clever structure to examine an big international issue, a complex issue where there's no right and wrong, there's no good guys and bad guys. And so obviously he did the drugs trade, but I just thought that would be a great way to make a film about oil and climate change. But obviously where his was fiction, ours was going to be documentary. That was the original plan 6 years ago. No, 7 years ago.
I mean, you made that film, and it was had a different title. What happened? I mean,
we had a rough cut. I wouldn't say we made it, and the working title was Crude for many years. But basically, I just didn't think it was good enough, because I showed it to a lot of people, and everybody who was really up on the subject of climate change was really understanding all the links and all the, you know, the subtle how the different characters were interrelated. But people who weren't up on the subject were just saying to me, you know, what the hell has that guy in India got to do with that woman in Nigeria, you know, and they weren't seeing it. So we basically went back to the drawing board and tried to come up with an idea to make it more than the sum of its parts, basically. And after a lot of soul searching, we came up with this idea of setting it in the future, in 2055, when runaway climate change has devastated the planet. And people are looking back at us now and basically saying, why are they not acting, or why did we not act?
Yeah, it seems to be quite a powerful... I mean, what kind of reactions to the film have you had so far at kind of early showings?
They've been absolutely incredible, I have to say, even though a lot of the people who saw it in the early days were biased, i.e. they were the crew or the investors or, you know, our family or whatever like that. But, you know, it was very normal to have half the audience crying and most of them laughing. There's quite a lot of jokes in it as well. Basically, once we started showing the almost finished film to people, then we just knew we were onto a winner. Not a winner exactly, but we'd made something powerful.
Yeah, I mean, the heart of it is these six human stories. How did you find those characters?
Well, basically, I just split the subject up into six themes, like, you know, war over resources or ever-increasing consumerism, and then got a team of 12 researchers to go out and just kind of amass ideas on those different themes. And the first one, actually, we came up with, well, the first one we decided on was the Indian airline guy, because that was just the right combination of factors. Like, we wanted to have a story either India or China, but India, they speak English, and it's much easier to film, you know, there's not so many censorship restrictions. And then we just heard that there was loads of airlines starting up at this particular time, and then researched all of those airlines and found this one particular guy who had this really interesting story. He's the son of a very, very rich family, one of India's richest, but he feels really bad about that he's really rich, and he wants to try and help end poverty. So he's decided to set up an airline so poor people can fly as well, which is just exactly the kind of story we were looking for, with lots of, you know, we just didn't want the black and white stories. The whole point was to show the complexity of this problem.
So there's a woman from the Niger Delta, for example, in Nigeria, where Shell and whoever are pumping oil and the people are kind of, you know, having their land polluted, for example, and she and her kind of family and village have kind of suffered pretty badly as a result. Is the kind of flip side of our kind of oil addiction that we don't get to see a lot of, really.
It's kind, yeah, exactly. Of, kind of hidden. I mean, they're, you know, they're living in absolute complete poverty, less than a dollar a day, but meanwhile Shell and the other oil companies are pumping out hundreds of millions of dollars from their land. So absolutely, that's one of the impacts of our consumer lifestyle here in the West.
Another flip side would be the war on Iraq. There's an 8-year-old Iraqi refugee living in Jordan after her home was destroyed and her father killed during the US-UK invasion. And you have an Alpine tour guide as well?
Yep. We wanted to find somebody who was experiencing real climate change happening. And we decided to choose the Alps because basically this film is going to be watched by a load of people in the West. And we just thought to choose an iconic thing like the Alps, rather than somewhere like perhaps Bangladesh or the Pacific Islands or something. Anyway, we chose the Alps, and then we thought, I mean, I can vaguely speak French, so that immediately meant we had to do in France. And then we wanted to find somebody who was very old, so they would have seen the widest range of changes. And in particular, we were looking for somebody who had grandchildren, because obviously the main environmental question is, you know, what are we leaving for future generations? So we set off to France. In fact, we got in touch with the French Mountain Guide Association, and they told us there was 2,500 guides. And we just emailed them all and said what we were looking for. And then somebody came back to us. It wasn't the guy himself, but said that I've got the perfect person for you. He's 84, or he's 82 then. He's the oldest guide still working in France. And he's not just got great-grandchildren, he's got great-grandchildren. So then when we went out to meet him, it turned out that he had yet another layer, which is that he's a real, genuine environmentalist. And he's planted 900 trees near his house. And he campaigns. He still goes out on protests and stuff like that. So it was funny, because when we were imagining these people, you know, I would always get to kind of, you know, one or two stages along, if you know what I mean. And then when we would find the real people, they were always much more complex and much more interesting and much more three-dimensional than I could possibly have imagined, which really kind of reinforced my belief, not just in documentaries, but also in, you know, humanity, which at the end of the day, is what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, they do draw you in, these kind of human stories, as I say, that are really the core of the film,
yeah.
And kind of give it the kind of documentary aspect. And then there's obviously the fictional element with the Pete Postlethwaite character as well, and then there's a whole bunch of animation that you've thrown in. So it's a kind of, it's not a simple film to pigeonhole.
It's not, but it's surprisingly straightforward when you watch it. When you just sit down and watch it for 90 minutes, when you try and explain it, it does sound pretty complex.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was editing it, the guy who edited it, he's edited more than 100 films, and he said it was 10 times more complex than any other film he's ever worked on. Not just more complex, but 10 times more.
Well, he's done a great job, I think.
Thank you very much.
How many years have you been working on it?
Full-time, 5.
You're really trying to go mainstream with this, aren't you, ideally?
Of course, there's no point making a film about climate change unless it goes mainstream, you know.
We kind of need to see some bums on seats over the next couple of weeks, really.
Absolutely, because what we didn't want to do was sell the film to a normal distributor, because if you do that, then it becomes theirs and they control the distribution, and then, you know, if you want to hold a screening yourself, or if you want, you know, say Greenpeace to hold a screening, they have to get permission from the distributor. So we didn't want to do that, so we've basically teamed up with this small distribution company, Dogwoof, rewritten all the rules, and we have managed to get it into a few cinemas, which, let me tell you, is a very difficult thing to do, but it now all, you know, it succeeds or fails on the opening weekend figures. All that happens is all the cinemas look at the opening weekend figures and they go, oh, that one's doing well, we'll have that one. Or nobody went to see The Age of Stupid, so it's all over. And just to make it even harder, we may or may not get cinema releases around the world, depending on how well we do at the UK. So to say that the opening weekend figures are important would be an understatement.
Is there anything else you want to talk about before you get back on with whatever you have, you know, 5 million phone calls to return or whatever it is you have to do?
Well, I mean, the only thing really for me to say is that the whole time I was making the film, I was thinking that the film was my contribution to climate change, and that as soon as it was finished, I would be able to retire and get a dog and see my friends and, you know, all the things that have been neglected. But basically, since then, I've been persuaded that actually the responsibility starts now. You know, we have this film, we own all the rights, we can do whatever we want with it. This is the year of Copenhagen. We've just got a few months left to either turn the whole thing around or basically it's pretty much all over. So that's what I'm going to be doing for the next year.
Well, thanks very much for coming on air.
Cool, thanks for having me.
And all the best with it.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay,
see you later.
Cheers now.
Bye.
Maybe we should take another breather. This is Franny and the Age of Stupid team heading off to Brussels to show the film to some people at the European Parliament.
We're on the Eurostar at some horrifically early hour of the morning. We're going to Brussels to the European Parliament, where we're screening to an unbelievably amazing list of invitees. Our plan has always been we want to influence the politicians, because obviously those are the people who are at the moment completely failing to make the laws that we need to stop runaway climate change. We've already screened at the UK Parliament, and in fact we got the highest ever turnout at an outside event apart from the Real Ale Festival. It's going very, very well in terms of the overall aim of Copenhagen in December this year, which is where they finalise the successor to the Kyoto Treaty, and basically they decide whether the species is going to survive or not.
Dames en heren, welkom in Brussels. Dat komen we in Brussels heute. Kijk goed naar de snittertermen in de
trein. Thank you.
The European Parliament, please.
We've got
-15 minutes
to set up.
Hey, Caroline.
Hi.
How are you doing? Nice to see you.
Is everything all right?
Fine. You?
Good.
Yes. Just a small setup issue.
I don't even want to know what it is.
We're going to aim to get 250 million viewers and then turn them all into activists. We're not bothering with the sceptics, obviously. We'll just leave them to argue amongst themselves. All the people who are really into it and are already involved with all the campaigners, maybe that's 10% of the population. And then there's the complete sceptics, maybe there's 10% of them. We're talking about the people in the middle. That's who we're going for.
I want to get your film in front of policymakers who are going to be making some key decisions between now and running up to the Copenhagen Climate Summit in December in particular. One of the lines from the film that really haunts me is that sense of, you know, why didn't we act when we knew what was going wrong? You know, why didn't we try to save ourselves, I think the lead character says.
Yeah.
I am constantly pushing this agenda and I need some help. And I think your film, frankly, is going to be a really big help. It's a real struggle, I won't hide the fact, to get the EU to do what needs to be done at Copenhagen. We need some really dramatic emission cuts to be agreed internationally at that time. At the moment, the highest ambition of the EU, anywhere expressed, and there's no guarantee it will even do this, is to have 30% emission cuts by 2020. That is not enough. That is not what the science is telling us. So I think the real challenge for everybody is to make sure that those policymakers in Copenhagen don't think they're in some kind of quiet room where nobody can see them. We need to be really clear that the spotlight is on them. They will be held accountable for the decisions that they take there, and that literally they hold the future of the world in their hands.
That was Caroline Lucas there being interviewed by Franny after the showing at the European Parliament. And we have Leo Murray in the studio, who's part of the Age of Stupid team. And actually, we must give you a credit, because that audio, which I kind of swiped there, is from a video that you put together.
It is.
There's lots of little video snippets up on the website that people can go to and access.
It's a very rich website, actually.
Yeah,
there's an awful lot there. You can spend a lot of time on the site. It's an exciting site to work on, actually.
And there's kind of new news stories every day.
Yeah, but new news every day. We're twittering now as well. I'm twittering.
Okay.
Twitter when I leave the studio.
Some kind of social disease, isn't it?
It is.
Perhaps we can talk a bit about the kind of policy side of what's going on at the moment, because I mean, Caroline Lucas made it pretty clear there that she's finding it really hard to get, you know, she's been kind of pushing on, I guess, her kind of Green Party mates. I don't know who else is supporting her in that work, but to try and get European policies that are consistent with the science, so that we have some kind of mandate we can go forward to Copenhagen at the end of the year, which is the kind of almost like make or break UN climate talks at the end of the year, so that we can try and nail this problem and get a scientifically robust agreement at a global level that will actually sort this problem out.
Yeah, exactly. All credit to Caroline Lucas. She is a dogged advocate of action on climate change. The truth is that the European Parliament, which, you know, she's a European parliamentarian, she's an MEP, as well as the leader of the Green Party, doesn't actually have legislative power. It doesn't really work like that. Caroline Lucas has authored all kinds of brilliant bills that have then been picked apart by the European Commission, whose job it is to do that. So it must be very demoralising to be working in that environment. And anybody that went to Poznan in December, I think most people came back really quite demoralised and depressed about progress towards Copenhagen at the end of this year, or lack of it.
Yeah, because what happened at Poznan as well is that the EU announced what their policy package was going to be for 2020, wasn't it, around that time? So it was like this is like what they were bringing to the table for the UN negotiations, in a sense, and it was pathetically inadequate.
It was pathetically inadequate. I mean, the key thing to understand about these negotiations and the EU's position in particular is that what we're winding up with as targets is political compromise. But of course, you can't negotiate. There's no negotiating with the climate. You know, what's coming from the scientific community, it ought to be, you know, climate change is a problem we only know about from science, and we should be writing policy and drawing up agreements which are based on the science and not based on political expediency and what people feel like they can afford to cough up for, which is what's happening at the moment. And you know, it's true that the EU is leading in the developed nations. I mean, there are other voices, marginalised voices from LDCs and small island nations who are calling for cuts which are science based.
LDCs, I should say.
Sorry, least developed countries. But in terms of developed nations, you know, industrialised nations who have responsibility for the problem and also really have power to reduce emissions, because most of the emissions are still coming from developed countries, nobody is calling for cuts which are actually commensurate with what the science is telling us we need. So what we have at the moment is I'm not going to get into numbers, but the important thing to understand is that if met in full, then the targets which are being put forward by the European Union would give us a 50-50 chance of avoiding catastrophic climate change, of avoiding catastrophic runaway climate change, you know, which is this crossing the 2-degree threshold where we don't know what happens after that, but probably positive feedbacks will kick in and we could end up with a 6-degree rise by the end of the century, which isn't just disastrous, it's apocalyptic. A 50-50 chance. You know, would you bet your life on a 50-50 bet? Nobody would. You know, I always think it's instructive to think of civil engineers in these situations. Civil engineers, when they build a bridge, they have a margin of error, right? They build a bridge. They don't build a bridge which has a 50-50 chance of falling down when people drive across it. You know, they build bridges to a specification where it's a fraction of a percent, a tiny fraction of a single percent chance of failure. And in this case, it's not just people crossing a bridge who are at stake. It's everything. It's absolutely everything is at stake. And the highest aspirations of any politician from developed nation is a target that would lead to a 50-50 chance of avoiding catastrophic climate. I mean, it's insane. People really need to understand the yawning gulf between where the politics is at and what the science is telling us we need.
Okay. Well, what we should try and get to, I guess, is how all this is going to interface with the film.
Mm.
You have some kind of parallel campaign.
Yeah, basically,
that people can get involved with, I guess.
I think Franny, you know, Franny's been thinking for all this time she's been working on the film. She's been thinking, this is my contribution. You know, I'll make this film and then I'll retire and go and live in the countryside and grow vegetables or something. But it became increasingly clear to her during the final phases of production that actually what the film does is it asks a question, you know, it raises an enormous question of individuals and of society. You know, that's what climate change does. You know, it's asking us a question for which we need to come up with an answer. And so Franny recognized that the launch of this film, if it does as well as we're hoping it's going to, and it's looking like it's going to, then it's an enormous opportunity to engage people with the issue and get them active and potentially turn the situation around and, you know, ensure that we have got a future. So on Sunday, Franny and Pete Postlethwaite will be launching this social activism campaign.
Sunday is also the world premiere, yeah?
We'll
talk about that
right.
In a minute. The
yeah.
people's premiere.
The people's premiere. So alongside the premiere of the film or off the back of it, Franny and Pete will be launching this campaign, the Not Stupid campaign, which is what I'll be working for after the film's release here, which the strapline message is turning 250 million viewers into climate activists, which is a bold statement for lots of different reasons. But it's not beyond the realms of possibility we'll get that number of viewers worldwide. If things go well here, we'll be looking at a US release, and you know, Canada, Australia, certainly all the English speaking countries have already got arrangements in place. But the question of turning viewers into activists, the film gets us halfway there, I think, because the film will be creating concerned citizens. People will go from not caring or not necessarily knowing very much about it to being extremely concerned. And then it's only a hop, skip and a jump from being a concerned citizen to becoming an activist. And what the Not Stupid campaign is going to try to do is to make that happen. We're looking to kind of be a conduit, really, to make activism accessible. We're going to have a matchmaker on the Not Stupid website where people that have seen the film can visit the website and they can answer a set of questions about their kind of interests, their preferences, you know, how old they are, whereabouts they are in the country. And then they'll be hopefully matched with existing climate campaigns. So, you know, things that are being run by NGOs and also like Transition Town stuff and other grassroots movements. And if there's nothing near them, or even if there is, you know, then putting them together with other individuals who've got concern that live near them and they can get something off the ground. But it's also about making people understand, as I say, the gulf between the politics and the science, and actually the gulf between political rhetoric and action. Because even countries that talk the talk on climate change, developed countries that talk the talk, are not walking the walk. You know, most people are not meeting even their Kyoto targets. So we're going to try to. It's very difficult to understand the UNFCCC process. It's the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and this is the process that gave us Kyoto, the Kyoto Protocol and will lead to hopefully a successful outcome in Copenhagen at the end of the year. But it's a minefield, and it's extremely difficult to unpick to understand at all for lay people. So we're going to try to educate people about how that process works, about where their nation stands in the negotiations, you know, what their position is. Are they kind of pushing for progress? You know, what are they asking for? And educate people about their national emissions, their per capita emissions, their per person ones, so, you know, just so you can get stuff into perspective, because it is quite instructive to see per capita emissions of a UK citizen next to those of a, you know, citizen of a developed nation, a developing nation. So getting people to understand the scale of the task, but then also to try to leverage it. So that's a very difficult thing to do, you know, from an individual standpoint.
Very financial crisis kind of word, but scaling up, yeah. Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, from where you're sitting at home as an individual, climate change is this enormous edifice, and the idea that you can have some kind of influence over an abstract thing like an international negotiation process seems quite unlikely, but that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a campaign that will allow us to get momentum to make that happen. So in Britain, we've got some domestic policies which are seriously undermining our negotiating position. And, you know, going to the international negotiations, Ed Miliband likes to cast himself as a leader in the international negotiations. And amongst developed nations, you know, that's kind of true. But if he winds up at the negotiations at the end of the year with plans for new coal-fired power stations in his back pocket, no one's going to take anything he says seriously. And so, you know, we'll be looking to get people to engage with that particular issue, and in other countries to engage with the significant issues for them.
Plenty for people to get involved with if they come out of the film feeling like, well, yeah, you know, I've really got to do something about this.
We're trying to catch people in that moment, you know. Yeah, we're trying to catch people in that moment where they're like, I really need to do something about this, and make it as easy as possible for them to become active in a way which is beyond the level of just lifestyle changes, you know, and changes in the way you shop, which is what most of the rhetoric around climate change asks people to do at the moment.
Okay, we should talk quickly about the People's Premier on Sunday, because that's kind of the fun thing.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the what's happening in Leicester Square first, yeah. And you've kind of got a solar-powered cinema and a pedal power popcorn maker and that kind of stuff on the one hand. Yeah. And then there's you're kind of linking into 64 other cinemas around the UK. So
yeah, amazing. It's 65 now at most cities in the UK. You know, it's absolutely all over the place. The idea of this People's Premiere was to make it inclusive rather than exclusive, partly because of the way that the film has been funded and the way that the film has been distributed, you know, in this very inclusive way, which bucks the normal way of doing things. So it kind of didn't make sense to do a traditional style premiere where you invite a bunch of celebs and you don't invite anybody else, you know. But also because, you know, there's this idea that everyone stars in the film, you know, we're all the self-destructive anti-heroes that are creating all the greenhouse gases. So Franny and Lizzie wanted to make it as inclusive as possible, but that we are still having the traditional sort of glamorous event in Leicester Square, although rather than using one of the cinemas, we've miraculously managed to get council to agree to let us put up an enormous tent in the gardens, and we've got solar arrays, mobile solar arrays charging to power the projector, and we've got gas lamps alongside the green carpet, which are going to be lit from reclaimed gas from London landfill. Things going to be heated by discarded Free London papers. So all this week we've had volunteers going around collecting, you know, I mean, the volumes of this stuff that there is every day is just extraordinary. So, you know, we kind of stood in Leicester Square and we're like, well, what can we use? And so we've got biodiesel from the chip fat from Leicester Square restaurants is powering what cars we're using. We've got a solar powered car on loan from Cambridge University, which they're refusing to insure Katie Tunstall on for some reason. I don't know why. The insurers were happy to insure Pete Postlethwaite.
They've got something against musicians, haven't they, insurers?
Yeah, no idea what that's about. Broadly speaking, the idea of it is it's going to be the most eco-friendly, you know, lowest carbon footprint per person premiere ever, and no greenwash. We're not doing any offsetting. Offsetting is palpable nonsense. And so, you know, we've asked everybody not to fly to it, and particularly to take public transport. So we've got various celebs that wanted transport have got various different things. So we've borrowed a Lotus from a gas reclamation company that's powered from gas reclaimed from landfill sites. Got a Tesla road car, which is also quite sexy and is powered with electricity from renewable sources. We've got a fair few people arriving in bicycle rickshaws, and I think Ken Livingstone's coming on the tube.
We didn't have a chance to talk about the science. Very briefly, Mark Linus was the scientific advisor, if you like, it. And but essentially, is it possible that he's kind of pushed the science for dramatic effect?
Well, this is not science fiction. It's absolutely not science fiction. This is not the day after tomorrow. It's very, very credible.
I mean, we're just talking about
it's a very credible perspective, yeah. Right? So the dramatic conceit is Pete Postlethwaite in the future. Everything is in a mess. Disaster struck. We didn't reduce our emissions, and climate change played out in the way that we expected. You know, there's scenes of destruction. There's Sydney burning. Opera House burning, you know, is one of the scenes that you see in the opening sequence. And of course, that's almost, I mean, Australia's been on fire for weeks now, and that's been directly linked to climate change already. So it's true that, you know, the scenario that's depicted in the film in 2055 is not, certainly not the best case scenario, and it's probably not the middle of the range either, but it's well within the bounds of what the science is telling us we may be looking at in 2055. And lots of people will find that difficult to believe, but it's absolutely true. It's completely credible scientific perspective. Yeah, it's not been pushed.
Mark Malines has written some kind of document to kind of substantiate.
He has. So yeah, anybody that's interested in the scientific perspective of the 2055.
We'll be able to see that at some point shortly. Okay, so People's Premiere is on Sunday, 15th of March.
Yep.
Go to theageofstupid.net to find out where. And then, very importantly, after you've seen that, you then take 10 friends.
That's right, to
the following
opening,
weekend,
yes, the following
when it opens across the country in UK cinemas.
Exactly right. So that's Friday the 20th. And it's opening. It's actually got, you know, it's got a 2-week run in 11 different cinemas.
Okay, we're going to play out with the trailer of the movie and a final quote from Pete Postlethwaite at the end. Thanks very much to Leo for coming in tonight. And thank you very much to Franny for being on the phone.
Thanks, Phil.
It's like looking through binoculars, observing people on a far-off beach, running around in circles, fixated on the small area of sand under their feet as a tsunami races towards the shore.
101 degrees Fahrenheit. It's the hottest day ever recorded.
It is our fault.
Of course, worried about global warming. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean...
Losing everything you have, it's so overwhelming, and the grief is just, it's profound.
The question I've been asking is, why didn't we save ourselves when we had the chance?
Evacuate! Evacuate! Evacuate!
That's it.
The airline business needs a face, a personality.
You're suspended. You're suspended. Both of you come to my office right now.
Police want her place to be like in America. They are living that kind of life. You just want to stay on Earth forever.
It's a fair fight. And I hope you lose.
What it normally always comes down to with wind farms is aesthetics.
Hypnotic. Driving along and you tend to see the cells revolving and you're like concentrating on the driving.
I feel really, really f***ed off with it.
Stare Mother Nature in the eye and then she dares you. Go ahead, do it. Let's dance.
Underwater
again. Come on, stupid gumshoot.
There was a great sadness in the ending of the whole idea that maybe we didn't think we were worth saving. Did you?
It's extraordinary. I did. Yeah.
Maybe it was that. Maybe we actually thought we're not worth it. That's a great indictment of all that achievement, you know, all that, the Caravaggios, the Rodins, the Mozarts, the Shakespeares. We weren't worth saving? Come on.